complexity of what it is you're trying to bring, and marshalling this almost breaching position between those who commission buildings and the society that use them, but also the society that don't use them but have to actually experience them. It's kind of quasi-legal, you know, it's a lawyer role, trying to actually find a way of simultaneous equations that can never actually be resolved. So you have to take a judgment as to where you feel you can never please everyone. I've realised that. I feel that somehow what we've achieved is important.
Graham Sterk is a partner at the internationally acclaimed and award-winning architectural practice Rogers, Sterk, Harbour & Partners, started by Richard Rogers. Sterk joined the practice in 1983 and has been creating thought-provoking architecture around the globe ever since, from high-profile office developments to luxury residential towers to airports and everything in between. He's designed iconic buildings on the London skyline, like the Leadenhall Building and Neo Bankside. Sterk's work on the British Museum Extension, five vertically linked pavilions housing the World Conservation and Exhibition Centre, has been shortlisted for the Stirling Prize this year. And I'm pleased to say, Graham Sterk joins me today here at Midori House for the big interview. I'd like to go sort of way back and ask you about your first steps into architecture, really. Were you one of these people who always knew this was something that you wanted to do? Was it particular buildings that saw you? Was it the influence of, I don't know, a particular individual during your formative years? What were the things that nudged you in that direction, if indeed you needed nudging?
I was always interested in buildings, usually. I loved castles, medieval cathedrals. I used to just really enjoy them. My mother and father used to take me to various places. Not a particularly academic family, but I used to just enjoy, I just enjoyed the feel of them. I suppose when I started, because I left school at 16, I think I was the only person who qualified with an O-level in maths. So that was the kind of school I went to. I started, first of all, thinking I love to draw. I enjoy drawing. And I thought it might be something that's quite practical, you know. Coming from a kind of northern working class background, you know, you kind of always told, well, you know, make sure you can look after yourself. I suppose I was never encouraged into any of the art world. I don't think I'm good enough, actually. There's nothing. It's probably better to have discovered that quite early. But I wanted to draw. I remember as a 16-year-old going from Leeds down to, I think, oh God, down way down south, seeing if I could become a cartographer, interviewed for the Ordnance Survey. Another time I was trying heating and ventilating draftsmen at the what was called the Property Services Agency in Lambeth. I was thinking at 16 to do that. It's crazy. But I did get a job at an architect's office. And so I was an office junior. I did all dog body stuff, you know. And that was my first wash with a series of people that were very different to people I'd ever met before. Mm. They were intelligent and witty and really clever and could draw a lot better than I. And I found it immensely intimidating. But so I started life as what was called an architectural technician. And then it was only after a couple of design projects that we were asked to do as part of, because I studied building, that someone had suggested it might be, you know, you might consider a career in architecture. And so I began to be interested, but I suppose the most formative stage was going to see a lecture. I was 18. It was a lecturer at what was then Leeds School of Architecture. There was a chap called Peter Cook was speaking there. Peter Cook was a founder of Archigram Movement. It's an amazing kind of pop art discourse on the potential directions of architecture in the future. And I remember some of the images he talked about, the urban mark. I remember thinking, you see this stuff, you think, you know, it's just another world, this Arcadian image of a future. And that really captivated me, I have to say. He wasn't even there. He double booked, so it was just his voice talking to this packed kind of lecture hall, just talking about particular ideas. So then I thought I'd like to study architecture, but I never... It's interesting, it's not something where you say, yeah, I know, this is what I want to do. Mm. It's such a complex subject. I was slightly suspicious when people say, oh, you know, I used to work with building blocks and, you know, I knew what I wanted to do. I had a social ambition. Actually, I think when you're younger, sometimes you don't really think those ways.
Mm.
I think it's a very, very evolutionary thing where even when I started in first year, I had a kind of slightly borrowed idea of doing well in the community. You know, you follow codes of what are important things to say. Mm. And then as you start going through as a student, you start evolving your own, particularly, many instances, high opinion of yourself, because it's actually a very, very small-scale world in relation to what practice is. And then eventually I won a scholarship to go to the Architectural Association where Peter Cook taught. So my final year was in his unit at the AA, and he was the one that introduced me to Richard Rogers. And an evening presentation, they chose a number of projects to show Richard, and that was the introduction. I remember I was going to go back to Leeds. I was so fed up with London. I was so broke after college. Peter Cook said, "You're going to go back and work with those people you were with before. Is that right?" He said, "I'm not having you going to Sleazebum and Partners." No, forget it. So I just picked up the phone and contacted Richard. I suppose that particular phone call changed my life.
Yeah.
In a sense of where I was then and actually where you evolve and what you become later. It's a journey. It's a path. And it's always slightly shocking, and it's a terrifying process. If I was really honest, you know, you spend hundreds of millions of pounds worth of other people's money manoeuvring these things through a society, various societies that we've worked across the world, that have varying degrees of expectation as to what it is you're producing, balancing that private world with what society is prepared to accept. I don't think I could have computed that when I started. I think you have to be introduced to it over time, really slowly. It's such a complex subject. So it's all a bit blurred. I don't know whether that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. It's really, really blurred.
I
just wonder then, on that point, do you think that, because you talk to a lot of creative people and they often point out a tendency to an over-prescriptive approach way back in there, careers, even back to, say, school days, and you sort of alluded to that there. Do you think we're better, I don't know, culturally, or even if we focus more on your industry, at being a bit more encouraging to people, not being so prescriptive, not saying, oh, well, you know, the way from A to B is this, this and this? Is there enough open-mindedness about that, do you think? Or can we always do better?
I think the lack of any overarching direction sometimes takes you on a particular path that I don't know whether I could have ever been encouraged to take just some risks I did, really, of trying particular things. There's an immense amount of naivety, which is immense, you know, there's a great deal of power in naivety.
Yeah. More than being a risk taker, do you think, in a sense?
The risk taking is actually not about I'm a daring person. I think sometimes it's about naivety. The fact that perhaps you might not be able to deal with the full consequences of what you're doing, but actually you'll find a way. But those things are always just, you know, they're strategies of how to move forward, especially in career terms. They're just ways of manoeuvring it through complex social environments, because it's not an art. It's not something that you're self-referential. It's a very, very social and technological kind of synergy of many, many different forces acting against you. So I sometimes see, you know, sometimes I joke with Richard, where someone says, well, this is my project. You know, you see someone, you know, another architect just talking about how clear they are and this is what we fought for. And when I'm working on Lloyd's of London, that's such a, you know, it's an amazing building, but it was a strategy. It just evolved and moved, and probably wouldn't have got there if you'd relied on just the expertise of a single entity.
Mm.
It's actually the marshalling of hundreds of intellects, pulling everything together as a kind of coherent organism, which is actually the fascinating aspect of what sometimes can be portrayed as a single art, you know, a single individual art form. You talk about collaboration, it sounds like we're all really happy go. Yeah, yeah, it's really nice. It's not, it's a bloody nightmare. And
I was going to ask you a bit about that, because obviously I suppose it's natural when there's, you know, really extraordinary talents in a field, yourself and Richard in this partnership, and Ivan Harbour, of course, as well. How would you characterise that? Is it a team? I mean, you talked about it almost in a more sort of organic way then. I wonder if that's how it is. Is it like sort of bodies operating that way?
It's an internal communication between ourselves, as I suppose, obviously, what Richard and Ivan and I have shared in common, because I've been with them more than half my life, is an intent. What are these overarching principles? What is it that we're looking for? And interestingly, it's not purely aesthetic. Mm. You know, there's a lot of core aspects of what is important in terms of, you know, the humanising of cities. You know, there's a whole series of things which help us to at least share ideas with someone that might understand. Mm. I suppose you could characterise it as shared values. Mm. And the values are not necessarily purely aesthetic. They're kind of, you know, there's a humanism, a technological aspect. You know, it's quite diverse. I'd rather see a fantastic, clear statement as to what something is. The beauty isn't necessarily something that's wholly engineered. Sometimes these things are what they are, and there's a beauty in that which sometimes isn't necessarily defined within any kind of particular doctrine.
Do you find, Graham, that if you're talking to, let's say we're talking to clients, a hypothetical client, do you quite quickly know whether they are buying into and understanding that sort of ethos, that kind of approach?
You have to build up a relationship, and actually it's a mutual understanding. It's not just my project. But I'm not here just to deliver a preconceived view. What you're trying to do is find, you know, common grounds and values that can be of importance as well. It's not just, we will make you a beautiful building. There's lots of, you know, airports tend to come with an awful lot of other things that one needs to get right before actually even the consideration of image. Mm. There's a number of kind of basic things that need to be, we say basic, they're quite complex, things that need to be resolved. So it's about a relationship and being able to at least align the vision so that it's not a singular entity. You know, we create catalysts that help to focus and might give responses or reactions, but then you then might, you know, our problem is, you know, these things last, you know, Leadenhall, I started that in 2001. It was finished in 2016. You know, that is a long-term gain. It's just particular metabolism, something that stops during an economic cycle. Then it restarts, it gets reinvestigated. And then you're asked to look at other particular aspects later on. And after a while, you start thinking, gosh, this is a 15-year-old idea. Are there other aspects you want to kind of maybe introduce? And what you realise is there are times when the strength of the diagram, it's actually quite nice having, balancing it with a little bit of hindsight. Mm. Because you tend, if you're not careful, if you're doing things in a complete rush, you tend to be quite rhetorical. And you will rely on, you know, we all have cluttered cupboards of images of what we think might be fantastic. I remember when I first went to college, I thought, oh, I've got all these exciting ideas. And after about the first term, you think, good grief, I haven't got a clue what I'm doing.
Was that a physical scrapbook of things you'd seen or pictures you'd taken? Or are you what kind of a record taker are you of ideas that pique your interest?
It's funny, I gave up photography quite early. You know, we were always recommended to buy cameras. I suppose it was only over the first 3 years where basically the drawing and recording of particular things, I realised I was seeing more. Because I'd sometimes go through photographs and think, I don't remember quite why I took that. Or it doesn't look quite the same in my head as it does now. It looks kind of quite ordinary. You know, it's like I remember having a college field trip, spending a week on the Acropolis, just drawing things, trying to draw a kind of capital on top of a Corinthian column. You know, it's like, whew. But what's interesting, I think it's more about being able to study. You know, and so I tend not to carry images. I think I carry notions or ideas. It's like I was very disappointed sometimes when I see certain buildings which I've always thought as iconic or fantastic, when I see the reality, it's not quite what I, you know, it's the power of the image.
Is there a, because there's almost a sort of a bit of a sort of dreamlike notion there, this kind of reverie of how things can grow organically. Is there always a bit of a literal or metaphorical abutting of the stark realities of whether it's a demanding client or the physical shape of the place where the building has to live or the materials that are or are not available? Is that always a, are those things in, is there a sort of a buffer moment where the idea meets those realities, or is that something that can work in a more fluid way?
I think it tends to be fluid. It's an interesting question, actually. Committing anything onto paper or onto a computer, anything, that first moment is terrifying.
Is that still, is it as scary now?
Yeah, no, I've got a healthy respect for the process.
Yeah.
I remember once, I mean, I did very well as a degree student. I kind of won prizes and got first and things like that. And there were times during that course where I was quite troubled. And it is that silly, you know, without sounding mawkish, I did speak to my mum, you know, because at one point I thought, I need to see a doctor. I'm going to break up here. And I said, why doesn't it come easy? I'm really good. And then you start the next one and you think, it's terrifying. Mm. And she says, well, the moment you think you've got it is when you've lost it.
Mm.
I suppose there are times when you have to throw things away. You have to murder the thing because it's not working. But what happens is that because it's promoted a whole series of dialogues that you would have never arrived at if you'd just started, it helps you then to trigger into another alternative narrative. I'd rather go into an alternative and coherent narrative than flogging the same one to death. And sometimes you've used one particular idea to trigger something else. And that's unusual, which that's about the first time I've attempted to articulate. You couldn't have got there just following logic. Mm. It's almost you've gone through this process and you think it's just not, and then you have a rethink, and then suddenly things all fall into place. And it's amazing how rapidly it happens, whereas you may have been flogging something for months and it's just not quite working.
So do you think, is that a sort of a variant of that notion that in a way you can sort of learn more from projects that don't go right, or you can learn more from mistakes that you might have made than you can from the unadulterated, universally acclaimed triumphs? Do you think, is there a truth to that notion?
I've learned a massive amount from competitions we've failed. You know, there always are R&D in a way, where you can test utopian models and explore particular directions. It's really, really fantastic. And sometimes you do make mistakes and you just think, it's of a period. It's where it was. It represents the period and the conditions within which it was established. And it's a true reflection of that. And sometimes those things are not always necessarily perfect and pure. It is a product of its time and it will be reviewed in the future, appropriately, maybe, or not.
And what about that idea of recognition? And I wonder whether it be, you know, official prizes that are awarded to architects for great practice or specific projects that are recognised, or even if it's something different and it's, I don't know, more of a media reaction or a mainstream reaction, or people who say, oh yes, I know you. Are you the man who did the so-and-so building? Is it important to be mindful of those? Are you concerned about that? Are you interested?
It's funny, I'm less so now. I remember when Lloyds of London was finished, it's quite interesting. Everyone goes, oh, it's really good. I've always loved it. Yeah, we didn't have any work for 3 years after that. You know, everyone forgets the hostility.
Yeah.
Richard always talks about the Pompidou Centre, where, you know, the reactions were not pleasant. He said sometimes if you don't create that reaction, you've failed. Something that sometimes is immediately loved and enjoyed isn't necessarily getting to the root or the truth that one might be looking for.
Mm. So is there that feeling with a project that does spark some quite incendiary remarks, positive and negative? Is there still a feeling that, oh, well, we've been successful then because we've prompted that dialogue and we've derived a reaction?
Yeah, I've got to be careful. I must say, I'm really stung by criticism.
Also still, though, even all this time later, you've had so many successes.
It does hurt, actually. Mm. It does hurt. It still hurts. Sometimes it does promote doubts. Just occasionally you think, maybe they were right there. And there's certain comments where you think, but there are other times when I think, I couldn't have approached it in any other way. Mm. I feel comfortable and I think I'm happy with that. And it's the best one could have created in that particular series of economic or technical or social kind of environments that we were working within. And sometimes I suppose criticism is always, it's whether it's absolute or relative. And sometimes if you take the absolute criticism, it's you can create any construct as to whether something's good or bad. I think I could probably go around every building on earth and find a way of destroying it if I was in terms of criticism.
Well, I was going to sort of playfully ask you that. And I know some architects are very uncomfortable with this idea because there's not a club mentality, but you'll see where I'm getting at. Is there a building that you would obliterate if you could? Not one of your own.
It's probably most of the what we call the hit and run stuff that I don't like. You know, there are some which draw attention and are lightning rods and suddenly become very apparent in press and publications. You know, I know that people talk about the walkie-talkie. There's a whole series of things. I think probably it's promoted particular discussions. You know, I'm not a massive fan, but it does not offend me as much as all of the hit-and-run kind of below-the-radar stuff that's ruining London, for example. And I think those, and some of them, you don't even know who did them. It's quite interesting that, you know, we'll produce something and it's like, it's like we won the Sterling Prize recently. We're still on it, I suppose, for the British Museum. And you get these kind of remarks and you think, well, it's been chosen out of all, you know, that's one of six out of an awful lot of buildings that have been given RIB awards. And then there's a particular level of criticism which relates, like, that it's not very good. You think, well, actually the criticism should be relative to the fact that it is there, rather than, well, I think it's disastrous, it's rubbish. And you think, well, okay, fantastic. You know, as ever, we're too dumb, we're too reductionist, and actually maybe we're just not intelligent enough for...
So does that prize matter? Does that recognition matter? Presumably you're engaged with being on a shortlist.
It used to be when I was many years ago. I've been on the shortlist 5 times. the first couple of times it really, I was bitterly disappointed. Mm. And then we had a very beautiful, simple timber structure on there. I remember 2011, I think it was Protos Bodegas. And when we were criticised for that being on the list, I thought, gosh, you can't even build a B&Q shed for what that cost. And it's a very, very beautiful building. I shouldn't say B&Q, an out-of-town shopping centre.
Other out-of-town shopping centres are available.
And, I have B&Q on my back now. but it was a kind of... There was a certain level of criticism that for a little while made me think, I'll keep going, but sometimes it can affect your faith in the society that you're serving, which is a shocking thing to say, is why am I bothering? And I do have those moments sometimes, you know, when things get really difficult. I think, well, maybe it's time to move aside or take more of a kind of engaging with younger people and kind of assisting them in their careers and things like that. Maybe I'll start doing I'll go on the charity route. You know, the complexity of what it is you're trying to bring and marshalling this almost breaching position between those who commission buildings and the society that use them, but also the society that don't use them but have to actually experience them. It's kind of quasi-legal, the lawyer role, trying to actually find a way of simultaneous equations that can never actually be resolved. So you have to take a judgment as to where you feel you can never please everyone. I've realised that. So the prizes that you asked me about is less important to me now than if I feel that somehow what we've achieved is important. It's always lovely to be recognised, but it's not as important. I think I've learnt that from Richard a little. It's interesting, when you go into our office, we've won hundreds of awards. hundreds of them. And we don't display them. And I think probably it's this basis of you're as good as the last thing you did. Mm. It's a state of mind in terms of, good grief, what's the next one? What a terrifying prospect. It doesn't help you.
It doesn't help. But also an exciting one. I mean, do you still think the next project or the current project could be the best piece of work I've ever done? Do you need to have that attitude?
Sometimes moments of clarity or moments of an idea that you think is a way forward. I have to say there's no feeling on earth like that. When that happens, there's nothing like it. It changes your whole demeanour. It changes everything because suddenly you can see a way forward. And sometimes that's quite early. Other times it takes a little time. And there's no feeling like it, I have to say. But it kind of just comes with a kind of miserable git period as well, which I do worry about myself sometimes, you know. It's because it's actually just trying to get somewhere that you can't quite see. And I find that really, that kind of duality of absolute euphoria. And that happens in stages. It happens at different aspects of projects. It's not just initial ideas, it's next stages of technological strategic design. There's a whole series of points and moments where points of clarity are reached. Mm. And the clarity is quite important to us because the whole legibility aspect of how a building manifests itself is immensely important. And when those moments, they come, and they're different types of moments as well. You know, it might be just a crude doodle or a rubbish model, but actually it's got some ideas and you think, gosh, there's something there. That's great. But it could also be a piece of structural engineering. It could be a whole series. It could be particular joints that can deal with complex interfaces across lots of different areas. And it's just certain points, you know, right down, you know, it's almost down into product design of some of the celebrated pieces in a building where you can find one thing that can work in 100 conditions. Those moments are just as good.
What about looking to the future, Graham? I mean, it struck me you were talking about, oh, you know, maybe I should talk, you know, to the next generation and help them and give them some guidance. It always feels wrong to sort of ask people about their ideas of their own architectural legacy or their working practices, the legacy of that, especially while they're still working and being recognised and being busy. But is that important to you? Do you look to the buildings you've worked on and think, you know, exactly going back to the point we made about the longevity of a great idea, that they'll stand the test of time and you're happy for them to speak for what you were about?
To be honest, yeah, I'd rather it be that.
Is there one already that you feel, hey, I'm pretty happy with that?
Oh, no, to be honest, there's very few things I've been involved with that I don't like. There are a few things that were stopped, which I'm glad they did. I can still look at my student work and I still like it, which is weird. Because most people say, oh, I look back on my student work, it's really dreadful. I think there's some quite good stuff there. And I think I'm just glad to be involved in this. I don't think I'm looking for a legacy. I mean, maybe I don't necessarily want that. I'd like for us to survive, because obviously we are now going into a next generation. There's a lot of different people, a lot of new people who've been with us for decades that we're working with. I feel a massive pressure to hold that, as Ivan does, well, the two of us talk about it sometimes because we live near each other, is a massive pressure to hold all of this precious intellect together. You know, and there's, you know, there's some brilliant people, and trying to hold that together is important, but trying to balance to make sure we can still stay relevant is, and some people might say we're not, but relevant is a relative term. And I suppose I'd like it if I'd love to keep going as long as I'm still relevant. I'd hate to just linger and hang around. I'd rather get the hell out whilst I've still enjoying these extremities of moments. I think I'd rather get out than try and set myself any ideas of will I be remembered, will I have... I think I came from nothing. I'll probably end up back in nothing, if I was honest.
So. Well, there's a beautiful circularity to that.
Yeah, no, I think it's just been a fantastic kind of fantastic journey, and that's kind of enough. Maybe it's a selfish thing to say.
The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.